Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello, everybody. Andy Burt here. Welcome along to episode 110 of the Early Excellence podcast. In this week's episode, we talk to Jeanette Quinn, who is the Director of Education and Professional Learning at COBIS. Now, COBIS, if you're not familiar with their work, COBIS is the Council of British International Schools. And in fact, they've got a big event coming up. They've got a conference coming up. It's in London from the 11th to the 13th of May. The conference is entitled Louder Than Words. And really interesting stuff. They're going to be looking at meaningful action around education design. They're going to be talking about well-being, sustainability, and a lot more. In fact, at Early Excellence, we're joining in with the conference. So we are on a stand 76. And we'll be taking lots of different things with us, lots for you to see and also to talk to us about. So come and see us. If you're coming along to the COBIS conference in London, come and see us at Stand 76. It'd be really great to see you. Okay, back onto this week's episode. I talked to Jeanette Quinn, as I said before, and we talk about all sorts of things. We talk about Jeanette's experiences of working overseas. We also talk about her work in schools as well, and that ethos, really, that understanding of practice. So, yeah, really interesting conversation. So here you go. Here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with Jeanette Quinn. Jeanette, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Hello, very well, thank you, and an absolute pleasure to be here today.
Well, it's great to have you here, and thank you so much for joining us. So we're going to talk about lots of different things, aren't we, as part of this particular podcast episode. We're going to be talking about your experience. We're going to be talking about COBIS and how you work and work with schools internationally. But I thought we'd start off. I know you've got a really interesting story in terms of starting points, really. You know, you've got this interesting role that I've just mentioned. But when we chatted before Christmas about kind of starting points, it was fantastic to listen to you telling me about actually how you got started with the line of work that you're now in. So would you mind telling everybody about the starting points in terms of your work? Would that be all right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I believe that all of us have defining moments in our career. And I think that I had been, I'd trained as a teacher. I'd been passionate about the fact that I was only going to teach older children, not younger children, but then was asked to do 3 weeks in a reception class, to teach in a reception class. And after 3 weeks, it was in complete shock, but then quickly realised that if you get it right from the start in education, all else falls into place. So at this moment, I had my passion for early years, but this was then combined with a great passion for international education and the impact that has on us as teachers. I'd been working in a school, and on the whiteboard in the staff room, someone had written, please, is anyone interested? We need somebody to visit a country, not specified, to look at a project in education, again, not specified, in a few weeks' time. Well, I always believe that if there's an opportunity, one should go for it. And I was intrigued. So I signed up, and a few weeks later found myself in South Africa, looking at a whole range of schools with an amazing group of 9 people from secondary, infant, junior backgrounds. And sometimes you have to go away to see things clearly, which might sound a bit mad, but everything sort of shifted in me. And at the end of it, I think I became the passionate person that I am, and it's defined me as an educationalist. And whilst in South Africa, I saw some amazing teaching taking place, amazing, in schools in Soweto where there was no resources, yet there were passionate teachers determined to make a real difference to the children that they worked with. And I've always believed that as long as you put the child at the heart of everything you do, and are passionate about what you do, you can make a difference. But there were people here with absolutely nothing. And it's very easy to make excuses and say, if only I had that computer, if only I had those super duper X, Y, or Z, if I had those resources, it would be all right. Yet if you're actually determined and solution problem solvers, there was a, you know, people were using bottle tops to use and teach amazing maths lessons. So I learned never ever to give up, to be creative, and to be grounded. And I also learned a lot about assessment. And I'd always been thought, why do we have to spend hours doing all this assessment? Which now I think, how did I ever say that? But suddenly that all went into place as well, because I was seeing where assessment didn't take place effectively. Children were going from place to place doing exactly the same thing again. And where it was taking place effectively, children were making huge strides in their learning. So I would say I then went on to become a head teacher in England and in Mexico City. And I think that was a defining moment in that.
It's an incredible story. It really is, you know. And also I think what's great is that the way that you're right, that kind of, sometimes you have to be further away to notice the details in certain things, you know, that, or you have to see the differences when you go to, and sometimes when you go to a different place, somewhere that's completely different to where you've grown up, or where, you know, where you're used to teaching or whatever it might be, that you see that space in terms of the differences, but then you also see the familiar differently when you return to it. And I you see what I mean? I think that comes across so well in what you're saying.
Absolutely. It totally makes you reflect on what you do. It's like holding a mirror up to you and saying, yes, I have been doing this and I need to do more of it, and this is why I'm doing it. Just tell you another quick story. When I was head of an infant school, we did the International Schools Award, which many of your schools listening to may be doing. And especially with early years, people say, well, how can you do that with early years? And I was head of an infant and nursery school. And the answer is, behind it is those key beliefs in looking at similarities and differences, relevant, highly relevant at all ages. And I found myself getting on a plane to our partner school in China with a suitcase, not filled of clothes as you'd expect, but being filled up with bookmarks, because all the children in my school were so excited about learning. Our focus was reading, and they wanted to learn and they wanted to share ideas. So our youngest children had done finger marks, the older ones had had a go at sewing, and I had every class had produced a different style of bookmark because they wanted to give them to their friends in China. And it had really helped us stop and think about what we did with reading. And the children made a book about reading, and they talked about where they like to read and what they like to read and how they learned to read. And so it made learning really meaningful. And not only were we learning about a new culture, we were making new friends, we were doing things at the level that was appropriate to us. Everyone was so motivated to learn to read. It was real. There was a reason for doing it. Again, another example of how those international relationships raise the impact of learning in wherever your school is.
Yeah. And presumably you take that into your current role. you know, a lot of what I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I'm assuming that a lot of what you currently do working for Covis is about those key principles in terms of practice, but also that kind of, I suppose, that network. So, you know, the network that you talked about, the link between schools and all of those sorts of things, actually, I would imagine is quite a part of your role at the minute, is it?
Oh, absolutely. I feel very privileged because Covis has really strong values, and absolutely networking is at the heart of it. And I always say we're like a big family of schools because we have schools that we support throughout the world, and we're all tied together by our passion for providing a quality education for the children that we work with. And so I have a diverse role. We do accreditation, Covis accreditation, when we go into schools to check. It's different from, we've got, you've, I'm just trying to think, it's different from inspection, but you've got the rigor, you've got accountability. Those schools have the opportunity to, it's seeped in ongoing school development. So the schools are reviewing what good practice is anyway. And we all know that the journey of a child, it's not just the one teacher, it's every teacher that interacts with them, the whole ethos of the school, the whole network of the school. So once evidence have been uploaded, teams go out to verify the evidence. And such a joy to celebrate successes and to give a really clear next steps as to where next. So the idea is it's not a full stop, it's ongoing whole school improvement. We also do I also do professional development. So for middle leaders, we don't wake up on the next day suddenly knowing how to do a middle leader. We train our middle leaders. We train people to train middle leaders. We train new heads. We have webinars, things for children. So we listen to our schools and meet their needs.
Yeah. Just going back to what you were saying, when you were saying that you see your schools, the Covis schools, as kind of like a family of schools, I've very much seen that in practice. So we've done quite a lot of work with the British International School in Amsterdam, the British International School in Belgium. So I've worked a lot with Esther O'Connor, in fact, who is the early years lead at the British International School of Belgium. In fact, she came on the podcast about a year or so ago and took us around their early years environments there. And when I've done training there, I've done training in sort of a few different sort of Covis schools across Europe. What's always interesting to me is that they always know, they talk about the other Covis schools as if they're next door. Practically, you know, and they're not. They're a plane journey away. You know, they might be an hour away by plane, or you know, more maybe. So they're not next door, but to them, they're their neighbours. And so, you know, quite often, I've been to conferences where actually they've put on an early years conference. Where actually, you know, there was one in Luxembourg that I went to, and I presented some training there, and it was great. I was there in Luxembourg, and Esther and the team came from Belgium, and you know, and the team came from different, you know, different places. And I'd met each of them, and they came along. It was like you know, you get sort of within a small local authority or within a trust, sort of in the UK, people come along and they've just come down the road. That was the mindset of the people who literally got on a plane or travelled a long distance. It was still very much they're just our partner school, so we come along, we support them. And I thought that was brilliant. It was really good.
Yeah. Absolutely, and our conference is always buzzing because again everyone flies into London but everyone is there to support each other and to help each other and that's so important. Can I just turn the tables for a minute, Andy, because I've told you about my defining moment or some of my defining moments. How did you get to be sitting where you are, Andy?
It's an interesting question to start with. And it's quite a nice question, actually. I don't think I've had anybody turn the tables on me before. It's a really interesting question. A lot There's probably a long answer, but I won't bore you with. But the kind of slightly shorter answer is that I think one of those people as an early years, as somebody who taught in the early years for a number of years, for quite a long time, I'm, first of all, I think one of those people who is fascinated and interested by the early years and is drawn towards it, not against it, not away from it, you know, not pushed away from it. You know, how sometimes, you know, when you work in schools, and I've seen this for myself firsthand, you kind of, there are some people who will be fascinated by the early years, fascinated by how young children learn, and will be drawn towards the kind of the slightly chaotic nature of it and the kind of the sort of maybe the noise or the sort of the freedom of it, maybe the less, slightly less structure. And then other people who will not like that at all and it be not their sort of thing. I was very much in the first camp of people that actually I felt straight away when I trained to teach, which was in the late 1990s, I did a PGCE. And straight away, through my experience on the practices, I knew straight away that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in the early years. I'd done practices in different age ranges. But when I went into my nursery practice, I thought, this is absolutely for me. This is definitely me. And so my first teaching job was actually within year one, first of all, and then very quickly into reception. But I knew that was the direction I wanted to go in. And I was interested in what you said earlier on, that you know, you believe that there are key moments in your life that shape your life. And sometimes you don't know that at the time. That's the funny thing, isn't it? You don't know these moments that happen at the time that they are going to shape your life. But I had one of those, and it was when I first started teaching in year one. As I say, I'd done a PGCE, and so I'd only done a year's training, which sounds crazy, doesn't it? A year's training to be in the classroom. And so I shot out of the other side of this training like a cannonball out of a cannon. and thoughts initially that, oh, yes, I can do it, you know, that kind of thing. And then, of course, you realize fairly quickly that what you know is the tip of the iceberg and that there's such a lot more to know. And luckily for me, there was a knock on my classroom door one day, and it was a lady. There was a lady standing there. I opened the door, and in she came, and she explained that she was called Pat Broadhead, Professor Pat Broadhead, and that she worked in Leeds as a professor, and she had the best job title of anybody I've met, and her job title was Professor of Playful Learning.
Oh, wow.
which I thought was amazing. Professor of Playful Learning, which sounded to me at the time like it was from sort of Harry Potter, you know, that kind of thing. Professor of Playful Learning. And what was great is that she'd been running a project with early years teachers and then wanted to carry it on into year one. And basically, I said yes. I'm not generally very good at saying no to things, and I happened to say yes. And it was brilliant because it led into this period of her coming into the room on a fairly regular basis, maybe once or twice a week. And the project that she'd been involved in was the impact of open-ended play in terms of children's communication and language and social skills.
How fabulous. Yeah.
It was amazing. So we set up we brought in these really open-ended things like cardboard boxes and clothes horses and pieces of big sheets of material and all pegs and all kinds of things like that. And then we basically would sit back and watch. And to me, it was perfect for that stage of my career because I sat next to an absolute expert. You know, for a whole afternoon at a time, sat next to an expert who basically taught me all of the things that I needed to know about child development as we were doing it. She taught me all of the things to watch out for in terms of those subtleties of what children will do, the eye contact and the different ways that they're communicating with other children, not necessarily speaking, but they are communicating. There were so many subtle things that I learned, and it absolutely impacted massively on my career. So I started to develop very open-ended approaches to my practice, as part of my practice. And that led into, in my second job, which was sort of 6 years later, I was an early years leader of a nursery and reception class. And I developed lots of very open-ended approaches, mostly outside, lots of really open-ended play outdoors, and some indoors as well. And I hadn't spoken to Pat Broadhead for a little while, since I sort of left my previous school. And I one day I phoned her up, and she answered, and I said, "Oh, do you remember me?" I said, "And we worked on this project." And she said, "Oh yeah, definitely." And I said, "Well, I've kind of carried on a lot of the work that we started. Do you want to come and see?" And she came over and had a walk around, had a look around. And she came back over to me and she said, "This is great." She said, "Do you fancy writing a book together?" And I was like, "What?" And she said, "Yeah, do you fancy writing a book?" And so again, I said, "Yes." And she arranged it. She'd written books before, and so she was all ready, you know, she was all set with for it to be published. And we did it so that she again would come and work with me sort of once a week. And then in the holidays and a half-term break, we would sit and we would write together. So I would go over to Leeds and sit in her office, and we would write together. Based on our observations of the practice, we would think and consider things and reflect and then write sections together. And a book came from it, and it was published in, I think it was 2012, it was published. And it was incredible, because overnight, my career kind of changed, really. I was asked to talk at lots of different events. So I talked at a TACTIC conference, so an organization for early years teachers, a TACTIC event, and that was in Birmingham, which again was just, that was just incredible to be asked to talk at an event in Birmingham. And talked at this event in Birmingham, and then somebody in the audience, I think, worked for Early Excellence at the time. Early Excellence were wanting somebody to speak at a conference, and my name was put forward, and so somebody contacted me and asked me to talk at a conference for Early Excellence. I talked at this conference for Early Excellence, and then what I didn't know was that they'd been advertising for a post, for a job, my current post. And so I kind of had a conference speech was my kind of job interview initially, I suppose. And yeah, there we go. It's almost like the rest is history. That's nearly 10 years ago now, which is crazy. I've been here now in Early Excellence for 10 years.
What a wonderful story. And it sounds, well, another story. It's real. And both of us ending up in our dream jobs. And it just shows the power of saying yes and just following your passions, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely does. Yeah, it absolutely does. Yes, definitely. I'm not very good at all at saying no to things. And I was chatting to a friend the other day, actually, about this, that kind of idea of not saying no to things. And sort of kind of, we were talking about it in terms of his job, the job that he's currently in, and how he was unsure at first, and how different people had said, "Oh, he should go for it." And that now he's sort of a year later, he says, "I'm really glad that I did, but I might not have done. I'm really enjoying it." And I was saying, it's good to say yes to things.
Yeah, not to have what ifs. And I remember when I went to when I went to college to do my teaching degree, I always wanted to teach internationally, but it wasn't until my own children went to university, I suddenly thought, right, if I'm not going to, I need to do this, or I'm going to have a what if. So didn't know where I'd end up, ended up in Mexico City, think, well, worst case scenario, I get back on a plane and go back home again. And it was, again, the most amazing experience. And at each stage of your experience, you you learn more, don't you? You build on, so you spoke to me just then about your passion for open-ending learning experiences and the impact that that can have. And now we just talk about it all the time, don't we? But at the time when you started out, that was a sort of what impact is this going to have, and what can we do?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I was thinking that as I was saying it, you know, that actually a lot of what we did in terms of the outdoor space with lots of open-ended materials, a lot of that is quite commonplace now. You know, a lot of the things that, you know, that I recommend that schools and settings have in terms of outdoor play, you know, generally is about the same kinds of open-ended materials that I used to have. But that's, you know, a long time ago now. And so, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and going to Mexico City, all the older classrooms had waiting lists, but the early years, it was about, and we also know the importance of communication, and it was that not realizing the power that really effective education in the foundation stage can have on the whole of your learning. And so it was talking to parents that understandably said, but why do we want to send them to school at three? Why do you want to do that, Mrs. Quinn? We want them at home. And it was saying, well, look, it's they're playing, but they're learning through play, and they're learning of all those different, and there's all those relationships, you know, and as you said, the enabling environment, developing that to make it happen.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's fascinating stuff. It's always interesting, I think, to hear different people's backgrounds as well, you know, and how you came to be where you are. Yeah, no, it's really interesting stuff. Interesting.
And again, there you are in the UK, and there am I in Mexico City at that point, having the same conversations, because it's important to have those conversations.
Yes, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I was going to then ask you about, if you don't mind, I was going to ask you about the accreditation scheme that you mentioned earlier on, basically about that kind of idea of, well, you know, how does it work? But also, how do we know that we have effective practice? I thought that might be quite interesting for us to almost sort of tag team it a little bit, because I think that's a really interesting discussion anyway, that I think both of us will be able to bring quite a lot to. Because that to me is that question, how do we know we've got effective practice? To me, is at that very heart of what we do in terms of education. And unless you're really clear on what it looks like, you know, whether you're a head teacher or whether you're an early years teacher or early years lead, unless you're really clear on actually what does effective practice look like, therefore, what am I aiming for, it becomes really, really difficult, I think. So I think that I hope people will find this really helpful. So from your point of view, in terms of the accreditation process, when you go into schools or when your teams go into schools, what sorts of things, particularly in terms of early years practice, what sorts of things are you looking for?
Oh, it's really funny. You can see me smiling at you, because I'm smiling because I'm thinking at the moment that, so the first stage of the process is schools upload all their evidence. But of course, it's then looking at those policies, and it's when you first walk into the school that you can feel it and sense it. And does that bit of paper looks good on paper? Is that what's really happening? And that feeling when you, that buzz when you walk into the school, that it's child centered, that positive relationships wherever you are, positive relationships, child centered, that the adults all know the children really well. As I said right at the start, those assessments, know your child and use them to guide the children. It looks like a really good, when you look at really effective education, it looks as if it's so incidental, doesn't it? Whereas actually you need to be able to, I remember sitting there and talking to someone and I was saying, you know, a teacher was doing a lesson and they said to me, the person next to me said, oh, look at them playing. And I said, but look at the rich vocabulary. Look at the way that she's sorting objects. Look at the open-ended questions. Look at the way that she's engaged every single child. So sometimes it's difficult to capture that and put it in a bottle, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And also, whilst there are these key things that we all talk about that are definitely part of effective practice, it won't all look exactly the same for every person in every school. And so you have your own way of doing it, but you're still getting to that same end part, if you like. Do you see what I mean? So engaging the children as an adult, one adult will be this sort of very kind of larger than life character, say, who will absolutely be, you know, they'll be like the sort of the Pied Piper who will lead the children and talking to the children, you know, and be part of absolutely everything. And then at the other end of the spectrum, I suppose, will be the adult who is really quiet and calm and gentle and not necessarily talking all of the time, but actually still engaging with the children in a different way. And there's absolutely room for both. You know, there's absolutely room for both of those personalities, and both will be engaging with the children in their own way. But the key is that actually they're doing it effectively.
Yeah.
And so it won't look the same everywhere. And yet we've still got to have quality.
Yeah, absolutely. And we, when we train our peer accreditors that go into the school, I say, you have to take you out of yourself, because, as you said, two different people, it can look differently, but what is the impact of what they're doing? How are the children responding to what they're doing? And that's why I think it's so good to have different teachers each year, different adults interacting, because different children will respond differently to different adults, won't they? And it's important that children have the opportunity to do that, and to learn the skills to engage with people differently.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So that as a starting point is great. You know, that kind of that idea of the buzz, the engagement, I think absolutely. And it's one of those things, like you say, you can sense when you go into a school or go into an early years classroom, you get a feeling of the buzz about the place. And I think it's interesting because it gives you a very good idea of the sort of practice that this buzz is made up of different things, isn't it? It's made up of there being a positive attitude around the place, people relating to one another, both staff and children, that people feel calm and settled. And
yeah, opportunities for the children to be independent, development of language skills. The learning environment tells you so much, doesn't it, about the beliefs and the way of teaching within the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's all of those things that come together. I think when we step into the room, we get this idea of there being a buzz or a purpose. And then we look in more detail, don't we, at the kind of, well, why is there this buzz? And then you see, well, actually, it's really well organized and the children seem really happy and they seem settled and engaged. And the adults also are happy and settled and engaging in what the children are doing. And you can see where this buzz is coming from. But it's very interesting. You kind of pick it up fairly quickly, don't you, I think. And so I was going to add another one in there, and which I think relates to what you were saying. And for me, it's about the characteristics of effective learning. And the reason for that is that I think sometimes we get very, we focus in such a lot on the what children are learning, on the kind of, this is the objective, therefore we're going to be doing this as an activity. When actually in doing that, if we're not careful, what we lose is the kind of the learning attributes that we could gain from this process if the experience itself enabled that to happen. So, for example, you know, there are different ways of teaching children, say, capacity, as an example. Okay, so you could teach capacity using, you know, potentially using a worksheet, and it's got pictures of containers on it, and you've got a picture of something that's full and something that's empty, etc. And you could say, well, you know, can you colour in the one that's full? Can you colour in the one that's empty? Do we now know the word full and empty? Of course you could do that, but actually, have we supported the children in learning for themselves those different learning attributes of working something out, trying something out, embedding learning, coming back to it, seeing it in meaningful contexts. We haven't really, you know, so really, if we're going to do that, it needs to be about thinking about the water tray. It needs to be thinking about the containers, the range of containers, the adults alongside the children as they're exploring, the opportunities to do that on a bigger scale in terms of maybe outdoors with larger buckets and larger containers and all of that, so that we're embedding learning in a very much a meaningful way and it's holistic. And so, do you see what I mean? So for me, if I'm looking at effective practice, it's got to be about the bigger picture of actually what's the quality of this learning experience and are we supporting the children in terms of those characteristics of effective learning, the curiosity, the making links, making connections, all of those things, or are we just ticking off the objective? And so for me, that's the my big one that I would look for, I think.
Absolutely. And again, I was smiling at you because immediately as you were describing those characteristics, I had a really strong image in my head of a school that I'd seen that had absolutely understood that. And actually, it absolutely was capacity. And because it was in a hot country, the children could automatically go outside. They had a range of different containers to use, but they'd also, all the appropriate vocabulary was displayed. They were using that vocabulary. It was a integral part of learning. There was one of the children writing things down and mark making, and they'd had a formal introduction, but then they had been left throughout the week to have this area that they could revisit, return to, talk to it, talk about it, use and apply the skills that they were learning to different circumstances, and also be resilient and turn take and problem solve and all of those things. So, as you said, a characteristics for effective learning. That is transferable.
Absolutely. Yes. Very good. Okay. Over to you. Have you got another one to add to that?
Environment has been something that recently I thought of a lot about, and we use that word enabling environment. And although I've talked earlier on about the fact that in any environment you can do your best, actually, when you're actually setting out that environment so that the children are automatically led to explore, ask questions in a safe manner, obviously enabling environment also means a safe environment where you feel safe to explore, safe to engage with learning. And I think that's an area which, again, I've been privileged to see some skillful teachers and to really see the difference. And again, it's that it looks seamless, but it's not. There's been an awful lot of thinking about how the environments are going, the different areas for each area of learning, the incidental questions that will be asked right at the right moment, the different things to develop fine and gross motor skills. But it's all of so much is encompassed in those two words, enabling environment.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it can be planned for, which is, I think, something that's often missed. I think often when we talk about planning, people, I think, link the idea of planning to something that's adult directed. So what are you doing in terms of your planning for this week? What we generally mean by that is actually what's happening in terms of the teacher directed stuff, and is it planned for, and to what level? Whereas actually the environment should be well planned for, and not just in terms of this week, but actually over a much, much longer period of time. So well planned for in terms of the layout of the space and what links with what. You know, have you put the right area next to another area? So is the For example, have you thought about blocks and small world play together so that they can be making story settings? Have you thought about paint and workshop together to really make the most of those creative experiences and so on? And that not only that, but you've also planned for what's in each area, as in what resources are there and how are they stored effectively, so that actually, in a way, although we're talking about child-led learning, child-initiated learning, and the children are having their ideas, so it is very much child-initiated, to quite a large extent, it's not really left to chance, because the resources that are in there are not resources that are just there. They are resources that have been planned for. So we know that we want, say, three different sizes of funnels because we want them to be talking about comparison and using the words linked to that. Or we want to have certain small world figures or characters because we want them to be talking about people who help us. We want them to be talking about the different farm animals or whatever it might be. It's all earned its place there and it's planned for. And I think that's something for me that often doesn't get talked about enough. It's often a bit of a blind spot. Interestingly, I've been doing, and the team, our curriculum team at Early Excellence have been doing a lot of work around curriculum with schools and settings. So we've been doing a lot of work on working particularly with head teachers around curriculum and with early years leads around curriculum and that focus on curriculum. And interestingly, schools will all, certainly in the UK, schools have all got this curriculum planning in place. So they will have a document that they've put together that says, this is our curriculum. These are the key areas of our curriculum. This is what we do, and this is what it looks like, and this is the planning for it, and it's a long-term plan. But interestingly, there's often a gap in there in that what's on the curriculum plan is what's happening in terms of the directed teaching. So these are the books I'm reading to the children. This is the topic we're going to have on whatever it might be, and so on. All fine, but it's very much about the directed stuff, what we're bringing to the children in terms of direction. It doesn't tend to include the detail in terms of what's happening in terms of that environment. But if you've got 3, 4, 5-year-old children, the directed stuff is important. It's really important, but it's not lasting forever. It's lasting for 20 minutes at a time. And for the rest of, or for a lot of the rest of the morning, you're actually going to be probably having the children exploring the environment, using the environment. So it's got to be planned for. It's got to be a big part of your curriculum.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, and that's where child initiated, it goes wrong, isn't it? It's when, it's child initiated, out you go. And there's nothing more frustrating for the child when the blocks aren't there and the things aren't there. And planning, you need to plan for success, don't you? And if so,
you do.
Yeah. Fabulous work that you're doing there, because without, it's key.
Yeah, no, completely. Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that I was going to sort of add to that is that I think when we're talking about, well, what is effective practice and what does it look like? I think as an umbrella term, relationships is a good term to use. Because for me, it's about how are adults building relationships with the children on entry. And that's a kind of a learning relationship, if you like, but also a relationship with the parents. So what do transition processes look like? Are parents coming to visit? Are we doing home visits to the home to go and see the children where they feel most secure, hopefully? Are we getting to know the children in terms of where they've been before, in terms of other settings? Are we getting to know what fascinates them? What really interests them? Whatever it might be. And so are we getting off to a really good start in that sense? But then also, are we then making sure that we're planning based on what we know about those children? So is that attention to detail? If we're building that relationship and we know it will make that child's day if they're crazy about dinosaurs and you've created a space for dinosaurs, then of course we need to do it. You see what I mean? It's that kind of, it's building that relationship. It's showing children that they, that we listen and that we value them and they have a place here. That, that in a way, I've said it before, but I think one of the things that I always aim for is for each child to feel like a bit of an expert in something, you know, and that's about your response to them and about saying, oh, you're our expert in this class, you know, on this, whatever it might be. You're the expert, and keeping that going. You know what I mean? So it's, for me, it's about relationships.
Yeah, and very powerful. And every child is an expert in their own way and in their own field. And that's that lifelong learning journey, isn't it? Feeling that you have something to offer, having the confidence to share your ideas, those development of lifelong skills from the minute you walk in. And as you said, that that preparation is so important, and being met at the door with a smile with somebody that knows your name and knows that you're very interested in rabbits immediately makes you think, oh, this sounds as if it's going to be okay coming here.
yeah, absolutely. It also, for me as well, I always used to take quite a while to remember children's names at the start of the school year. I discovered that if I did a home visit, because I knew something about the child, that they were fascinated by superheroes or rabbits or whatever it might be, it was almost like I could remember the child because I could remember something else about them that helped me to remember the children's names. And I think actually that is all important. It helps you to build that relationship. It's not just that they're not just a child in the class. They're not just a name on the register. You know, they're a person with interests and a background there.
Absolutely. And if they're sitting there worrying about something, how can they begin to start to learn? So the quicker they feel settled, the quicker. And again, we go back to that planning, that attention to detail, preparing as much as you can so that setting them up for success as they walk through that door. Interestingly, at COBIS at the moment, we're just producing the COBIS program for early careers teachers. And again, that is having those conversations, supporting people. You spoke about doing a year earlier on, and then there you are. You use the expression like a cannon going out. and I think you become a teacher, and however much you prepare, there's still so much to learn. And it's been really interesting because developing this program, so many people were saying, oh, can I just contribute to that? And I know, again, going back to the start with our family of schools, if everybody in the family of schools and has 20 minutes to just stop and share something, those experiences are going to help our early teachers to hit the ground running and to help with that planning and that preparation and to have the biggest impact.
Absolutely. It kind of feels like the conversation's gone full circle because you also, I think, the longer that I've been sort of in my current job, but also kind of working around education and early years education specifically, is that you're aware that there were moments in your own career that changed your career. As I talked about earlier and you talked about, moments where you met certain people or somebody gave you this advice or whatever it might be that actually changed your outlook or changed the way that you look at something or changed how successful you were at something. And you're aware, I think, increasingly aware, I'm increasingly aware, that actually that sometimes, you know, you're also helping the next person. You know, the person who is the early career teacher, and you could say, well, actually, you know, you could do it slightly differently to that. You know, you're working really, really hard, but actually what you could do is you could do a bit less and be more effective if you did this. So it's just helping, you know, you see what I mean? Kind of helping somebody along a little bit. Because everybody needs that. You know, I needed that when I first started. One of the other examples of somebody kind of helping is I remember in the first week or two, an experienced teacher who was in the next classroom to me when I first started said, just come through here. I'm putting up a display. I'm doing the backing paper or whatever it was. I'll show you how to do it. She said, because nobody showed me, but I've learned how to do it. And she said, I can help, I think. It's not rocket science, she said. You know, I'm not claiming it's anything major, but let me show you. And it really did help, because, you know, you go through that stage as an early career teacher where you kind of put up a display and there's just this great big air bubble behind it. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of, you can kind of push it and it will come back out, you know, that kind of thing. And she sort of said, well, you have to do it in this order. You start from the bottom and then you overlap each one over the top. And then you don't, you're helping it to kind of, you know, you're holding it all together. And it's the sort of thing I could have carried on doing displays to this day and still not got it if somebody hadn't shown me. We all need at times, I think, somebody to just sort of point you in the right direction with things.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Jeanette, it has been absolutely wonderful to speak to you. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been brilliant to chat through things with you.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I've really enjoyed learning a bit more about you as well. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, thank you. Take care. All the very best. So there you go. Thank you very much to Jeanette for joining us for this week's episode of the podcast. And of course, to you people for listening along as well. That's about it for this week. Just very quickly to remind you of that conference, the COBIS conference in May. If you are coming along, and I'd certainly recommend it, sounds fantastic. If you are coming along, either as an organizer or as a delegate, then do come along to our stand, Stand 76. Come along and say hello. It would be great to see you. All right. That's about it for this week. Thank you very much for listening, everybody, and we will see you next time.